everyone, and welcome back to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm your host, Dr. Catherine Niche. I'm a professor of earth sciences, a planetary geologist, and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores. I'm a professor of space engineering at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, and a speculative fiction nerd. And today I had the opportunity of picking the movie that we would do. And this is an interesting one, I think. This one is clearly for you. And the reason that it's for you, our dear listeners, is because neither Catherine nor I are big Star Wars fans. So we're doing Rogue One, in some ways the least Star Wars-y Star Wars movie that there is out there, really. So for me, this was something I remember enjoying, but not thinking terribly deeply about. You know, it was fun, but then it was over. And I'm kind of curious, you know, what your relationship to this movie was when it came out, Catherine.
You know, I was struggling to remember if I even saw it in theaters. I distinctly remember seeing the next movie that came out, which would have been The Last Jedi, which came out in 2017. But I really don't know if I saw Rogue One in the theaters or not. So yeah, it clearly did not make much of an impact on me. And in fact, when I went and watched the Andor series, which came out in 2022, and then the second season just aired, I totally forgot about that character. I didn't know where it came from. So clearly it did not make a big impression on me. As John said, I'm not a big Star Wars fan. I think a lot of that is just timing. Star Wars is for Gen X. I was not a sentient creature when the original trilogy came out, so I never watched it. I think I first saw A New Hope in college, so this was right around the time the prequels were coming out, but I think since I was just so small when Star Wars came out, it just didn't make a big impact on my life and has sort of been that way ever since.
It is fun, I think, because I remember on another popular sitcom, How I Met Your Mother, they had this whole thing about telling somebody's age by how you respond to the Ewoks, whether you think they're, you know, creepy and weird or whether you think they're cute and cuddly. And I think we're pretty close to that divide. I remember walking into grad school at Arizona and so much Star Wars stuff, you know, pasted up on the walls from people who felt, let's say, a little bit differently than I did about that series.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the Star Wars toys and, you know, pillowcases and the like, but I didn't really know where it was coming from or what the context was. It just hasn't had a big impact. I have really enjoyed, though, the more recent series. So as we'll find out, I'm not actually a big Rogue One fan, but I did enjoy the Andor series quite a bit, as well as The Mandalorian. So I think some of their television shows of late have been pretty good. But yeah, none of the movies really stand out to me in any particular way.
So perhaps what we'll do then is we'll start with just a quick little summary. I think this is the biggest box office, or close to it. It's up there with Thor, I think, in terms of, you know, how many people have seen it. But just to give a quick little summary of the film to you, we have here a movie that is essentially based off of one line from the original Star Wars movies. The line is, "During the battle, rebel spies managed to steal secret plans to the Empire's ultimate weapon, the Death Star." And so Disney, having recently acquired Lucasfilm, decided, let's make a movie out of that. And what they came up with is this narrative in which you've got an engineer who works for the Empire, but whose sympathies are elsewhere. He's sort of forced to work on this ultimate weapon, the Death Star, and his daughter escapes. So his daughter is named Jyn Erso, and she escapes. She doesn't really love the Empire or the Rebel Alliance all that much. But as the weapon gets close to being finished, the scientist, the engineer, his name is Galen, lets it be known to her by secret means that there is a secret flaw that he has designed into the Death Star. And so most of the movie is Jyn working with another character, Cassian Andor, who we've all come to know and love recently, who then work to find those plans that show this particular flaw and to get them back into the rebels' hands so that, you know, all the good things that happen in the very first Star Wars movie from 1977 can unfold.
There's a planet-wide defensive shield with a single main entry gate. This shuttle should be equipped with an access code that allows us through.
Assuming the Empire hasn't logged it as overdue.
And if they have?
Then they shut the gate. And we're all annihilated in the cold, dark vacuum of space.
Not me. I can survive in space.
You know, that's sort of where this one comes from. It doesn't feel like it has a ton of deeper meaning than that. It's just a fun little romp. But I remember at the time, it was really unique in being a Star Wars film where everybody died. All the main characters are dead at the end. So, you know.
Well, and you know that going into it, right?
Exactly.
there's no happy ending.
But of course, you know, this being, you know, a fictional universe, you know, there's always ways to bring back characters who are dead or go to their past, which is why we just had the Andor series as well. So let's go ahead and get into the science gripes. And we'll try not to make this an entire show about science gripes today. Let's see if we can do that, Catherine. What do you want to start with?
Let's start with their spaceships. There's a couple things we can talk about their spaceships in the Star Wars universe. The first is the jump to hyperspace, which I think it appears in most of the Star Wars movies. Here it happens quite dramatically as they're trying to escape basically an impact crater that's being formed. And they jump to hyperspace right out of the atmosphere. But this always stands out to me because they basically go from 0 to 60, where 60 is the speed of light, way, way too quickly. The sorts of accelerations that you would experience if you did that would be fatal. I looked it up, and the most G-forces that a pilot can sustain is about 9G, so that's 9 times gravity on Earth. And that's, you can only sustain that for a second or two. And what we're talking about, from going to 0 to light speed, that would be millions of Gs. So nowhere near what a human could actually tolerate. So you'd almost certainly die if you did this jump to hyperspace. And John, you actually had an interesting thought about maybe a way you could work around that by actually dying and being resurrected.
That's right. And this one I owe to Dan Simmons. So this in space travel is, I think, known as the strawberry jam problem. The idea that at the kinds of accelerations and movements that you have to do to get anywhere in space in a reasonable amount of time, everybody on the inside essentially just gets completely disrupted. And there are various solutions to this within science fiction. Dan Simmons, in his Endymion duology, actually has a device that members of, you know, I guess this is kind of like similar to the Empire in some ways, but, you know, more of a religious cult. They have these devices and these very fast ships, and the ships intentionally kill the pilots and all the people. That's really great, because during the transit, then they consume no resources. It makes these ships very efficient. And then when they arrive in their destination, they are all painfully resurrected by the device, which has the memory of, you know, their shape and form and memories and thoughts and whatnot. So they're resurrected.
I mean, clearly we don't see that in the Star Wars universe, though. They just get slightly knocked over sometimes in the jump to hyperspace, but certainly not turned into strawberry jam. You can reach the speed of light through constant acceleration, but it would take about a year. And that would make for a pretty boring movie. So here, yeah, the Star Wars universe is not realistic, but you can see why they do it for narrative effect, right? It'd be really boring watching Andor just sit around for a year while he waits to get to the next planet.
Oh, it's true. And I think that they have really good control of gravity. That if you're going to make an argument for how this works, it would probably be something along on those lines. Personally, with my spaceship, if I was feeling a little jolt as we were going to hyperspeed, I would be very worried that there's something wrong with that gravity control and that compensator. It's also got to be really, really cheap to do this. Like they found a solution that makes it easy, because their spaceships are designed in the least aerodynamic way possible. It's like, can we pile extra weight and bulk onto these things? Sure, let's do that. Apparently, it just doesn't matter. We've got this very powerful way of moving between these different places.
Yeah, you're right. None of these spacecraft look particularly impressive. They look kind of tacked together by duct tape in some regards. So clearly there's some cheap, easy, small energy source they use to get them around. As John mentioned, they also seem to have control of gravity. In one of the scenes in this movie, you see a Star Destroyer just hovering over, was that Jedha City?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, which doesn't make any sense. I mean, you can see the rockets on the back that would push it forward, but nothing to hold it upwards. And so I guess this is just a MacGuffin in the Star Wars universe called the Repulsor Lift that my husband pointed me to, that makes everything sort of float. You know, they've got speeders too with no wheels. They just sort of float around. There's no science there. They just have some something, some magical thing that can help them float, essentially. So again, not great from a science perspective. I don't think they ever try to explain it either. It just looks cool. I think that was the main reason why they did it.
Oh, 100%. Catherine and I were discussing just before we came on here, sort of the philosophy of, you know, how you do science fiction in Star Wars versus Star Trek. And it seems kind of like in Star Trek, they might start with, you know, oh, here's some interesting science. Let's create something that gets around this for narrative purposes. Whereas Star Wars, they just do stuff that looks cool. And then later on, they figure out it uses this, right? And we see that sort of throughout. You're going to hear this as a constant theme today, you know, when we talk about all sorts of topics. To get back to the gravity thing really quickly, one of the things that I think really bothered me was that, and again, it's a little bit of that comparison to Star Trek. You always see the planet turning under the spaceship, you know, under the Enterprise when you're looking at Star Trek or your favorite, you know, starship. When you're looking at Star Wars, that just doesn't happen. And when you are looking at it with the eye of somebody with some orbital dynamics knowledge, it's just so weird because they're so low and they're close to the planet. So they're not in a synchronous orbit, but they're just sort of hovering there and floating there with the planet in the background. They're not in orbit at all. So it's this weird gravity thing. And I think this movie is kind of the worst offender that way. You have that little shield generator station that is not really very high above the planet at all, and yet moves with it without any obvious propulsion. And Catherine, I get you 100%. It drives me nuts when the engines come on in the back and the ship goes up.
Yeah. So yeah, no science there. As we talked a little bit in our Star Trek episode, I kind of don't mind when they don't explain it. It's when they try to retroactively explain things with vaguely sciencey sounding things that bothers me more. But both Star Trek and Star Wars are both offenders here. You know, the Force, clearly just magic, right? There's no science there. So when they tried to go back and explain it using, what was it, midichlorians?
I think midichlorians in your blood. Yeah.
Yeah, like that just makes it worse. Just leave it as magic. You know, as we talked about in the Thor episode, sufficiently advanced science can be seen as magic. So maybe it's just something we don't understand yet. And I'd rather they just leave it at that and not try to explain it. To me, that makes it worse. And so Star Wars is a bit of an offender here.
It's true. I feel like with Star Wars, the more you dig into, you know, how things are operating, the more pain you create in yourself looking at these things with a scientific lens. I know that we've done a few calculations as we've gone through this series, looking at a particular scene and wondering, oh, you know, what does that mean? And I saw a scene when we were doing this, which I thought was really kind of weird, looking at the Death Star being built and putting that super laser emitter in and just sort of watching that evolve over 73 seconds in the background there. The shadows change and you actually see this this big piece of hardware, 36 kilometers across, descend into the Death Star. And it looks slow, but it looks slow because you're so far away. If you actually take the shadows, you calculate the speed, that thing's being installed at 600 kilometers an hour, which probably exceeds workplace health and safety guidelines for moving something of that bulk and weight.
To be fair, I don't think the Empire cares about work and safety guidelines, given everything I've seen about them.
It's true, but do they have a replacement part for that if they mess up the install? Probably not.
Sure. But they're not known for their health and safety requirements. Yeah, there were a couple of scenes like that where when you actually look at the timing and sort of the dimensions, it doesn't make a lot of sense. For example, the very final scene where Andor gets crushed by a tsunami. I went back and tried to see like how large of a tsunami an impact crater of that size would make. I know the Death Star is not lobbing asteroids at its planets, but an impact crater is the only thing I could compare it to. It seemed like the closest analog. And so I guessed it was about 200 kilometers wide. That was just a guess. Honestly, it was really hard to make out scale on that planet. But Chicxulub, which was an impact crater, that's actually the dinosaur-killing impact crater, impacted the Earth 65 million years ago in the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. And this was a large impact into a body of water. So it also would have made a tsunami, not dissimilar to the one we saw at the end of Rogue One. And they've done some modeling work that showed that tsunami would have been originally 4.5 kilometers high and then sort of petered out to to more like 1.5 kilometers high. So that's an incredibly high tsunami. And certainly the tsunami was large at the end of Rogue One, but there's no way it was several kilometers high. So yeah, the dimensions there don't really work out either. Yeah, I've got a lot to say about impact cratering, but maybe we'll leave my other complaints till later.
I don't want to foreshadow the science shine, but I guess one thing I do like about the Death Star, and like the only thing really, is that it seems like all the energy is deposited in one place, which is not unlike an impact. Now, they fire the Death Star in places that are silly. Like they come right on the horizon and there's an eclipse in Jeddah. And then the Death Star fires the super laser at like the most oblique angle possible through the atmosphere to ensure they lose as much energy before they hit their target and ionize as much atmosphere as possible. You probably wouldn't do that. But it does look cool, you know, again, getting back to, you know, that aesthetic, which I think dominates.
Yeah, I mean, the Empire is mostly about intimidation, right? Not about efficient use of resources is kind of what I see. So, you know, as long as it looks cool and intimidates people, that their goal is achieved.
Definitely. Well, do we want to jump on to one of the bigger elephants in the room and talk about the weapons, the blasters, and the lightsabers a little bit?
Sure, yeah. Do you want to start that?
Sure. So I'll start with the blasters. I know you've done a deeper dive onto the lightsabers. So something that always bothered me about the blasters is the bolts. They seem to travel fairly quickly, but you can actually see the motion. So that means that they're actually traveling quite slowly. And, you know, modern weaponry we have today moves much faster than these things. You see people knocking bolts away with those lightsabers, and you see them jumping out of the way, especially when they have the, you know, a little more midichlorian in their blood that day, and they can use the force just a smidge more. And it strikes me that this is not a terribly efficient weapon. It's also very strange that you can see them in space, too, where there's not a lot of atmosphere or molecules or anything to scatter that light towards our eyes. When you take a laser and you shine it through a vacuum, unless your eye is being hit by the laser, you can't see that beam at all. So, you know, it's interesting that way.
I've read up a little bit about the blasters and the lightsabers, and I don't think they're actually lasers. The common wisdom on the internet seems to be that they're plasmas confined within a magnetic field. So I think you would see a plasma in space, right? I mean, the sun is a plasma. So
true, true.
So I think that's okay. And you wouldn't expect a plasma to go as fast as the speed of light, and maybe not even as fast as a bullet. I don't know. I've never made a plasma bullet before. So I think that's okay. But how would you contain a plasma within a magnetic field from such a small pistol? That's where the problem, I think, comes.
And how do you keep it contained as it moves and it travels further and further away from the device that emits it?
Yeah, I don't know. So I did find a YouTube video, though, of a guy who's trying to make like a real life lightsaber, which basically is just a giant plasma torch as far as I could tell. It looks really cool, but it doesn't do the same thing that lightsabers or these blasters do. For example, it wouldn't like hit another lightsaber and stop, which is what you see in the movies, or deflect something like Darth Vader does at the end. It melts metal. So that's good, but it doesn't actually stop when you hit something. And it's not clear that that is even possible. Even if you did have two plasmas confined within magnetic fields, if they hit each other, right, those magnetic fields would merge and there'd be a huge release of energy, not just the, you know, kind of clink, clink. They make a different noise. I'm not good at making it, though, that you see in the movies when the two lightsabers hit. And as I mentioned, you'd need like some sort of power pack and maybe a gas source, like a little backpack. You don't see Darth Vader wearing a little backpack. You know, it would disrupt the aesthetics of his cape too much. So who knows how they've gotten all that energy and gas stuffed in the little tiny handle of a lightsaber.
Well, fortunately, they've got kyber crystals.
That's right. Whatever those are.
Well, I mean, we know that the strongest stars have hearts of kyber.
Yeah, I didn't know what to make of that line. A, what is a strong star? Do they mean large stars? I don't know what a strong star would be. And they don't have hearts of kyber, right? It's just, the sun is a giant ball of plasma, you know, with hydrogen and helium. There's no solid in the sun.
And here I thought that the strongest stars had Mjolnir at their core.
That's right. Why can one star make a hammer and another one make a crystal? Clearly Asgard and Star Wars are in different universes. I mean, everyone does love a good multiverse, right? So
it's true. And it was fun to see in the Andor series that predated this one. Good to see Stellan Skarsgård again.
I know. We got two Stellan Skarsgård sightings in subsequent weeks. So no, fan favorite. But one thing I will say is you're not going to make a crystal like that in a star, but you can form new elements. And actually, I thought it was cool that Galen called his daughter Stardust because, you know, we're all made of stardust, as Carl Sagan famously said. Stars fuse hydrogen into helium, but clearly we're not helium clouds. We're made of carbon and nitrogen, oxygen and whatnot. And so those elements come from stars, particularly large stars, which fuse all the way up to iron and then explode into a supernova and distribute that material throughout the universe. So you're not going to make a crystal, but you can make new elements from stars, and those can be distributed.
Definitely. And the most exciting elements, if you are thinking about generating power from crystals, so thinking about minerals that do this, like uranium minerals, for instance, those actually get created in the supernova themselves. So they're not even at the heart of the star anyway. They're in that expanding cloud of material that comes out. So, you know, making a weird jump here to other clouds, I want to talk about the moisture evaporators. So we encountered these things in the original Star Wars, which was, you know, started out on Tatooine and, you know, the desert planet. And it kind of makes sense there. You know, this is a place with not much water. You want to get every drop you can get by bringing it in from the atmosphere. But weirdly, in this particular movie, when, you know, Jyn Erso and her father, you know, are first approached and he's taken away, they're sitting in a place that is, for folks, I guess, like myself and Catherine, obviously Iceland. And they have the same moisture evaporators. You can barely see them through the fog. And it struck me as such a strange environment to have that same tech. I mean, it keeps the aesthetic, but, you know, it doesn't make sense in this particular setting.
Yeah, that whole scene was just super weird. Like, you would not choose that place. It looked like an alluvial plain with a braided river system going through it. That is not a place you would set up a farm. And indeed, it's probably too cold and the growing season might be too short for farming to be reasonable. I've done a lot of field work in Iceland, and, you know, most of the farming you see there is animal husbandry. You see sheep and whatnot grazing upon the land. You don't see large fields of grains, which I think is what they were farming in this scene. So the whole thing just struck me as very unrealistic, but maybe that was the point. Maybe he wasn't actually trying to farm. Maybe he was secretly continuing his work and the farm was just a cover, because none of this makes sense.
Well, before we finish up with the science gripes, I think there's a few more items. What do you want to go for, Catherine?
I think I want to talk about the holographic messages, which are, you know, in every Star Wars movie and television show I've ever seen. So rather than just texting people, which is, you know, what most people do these days, they need to send a full holographic image, video, audio, which seems terribly impractical to me. When you're thinking about data rates, holograms are going to be the largest one. In fact, I found an article that said dynamic video holography would need terabytes per second data rates in order to work. So why not just send videos or audio files or text files, all of which would be smaller than a hologram? I did find some rationale online for why you would need a hologram, but none of them seem to explain why you would do that in favor of simpler and less data-heavy methods of communication. I mean, yeah, it's great to see someone's reaction on screen, but you can do that with a video. You don't need a hologram. But maybe this is why they have that data storage center that's so enormous to fit all these holographics.
Well, at least in their defense, the holograms that exist in Star Wars are extremely crappy and terrible and low resolution. So maybe, you know, they're trying to save a little bit of space there. But again, you know, I like that you brought up that facility on Scarif, right? With the huge dish at the top. And it's so strange. Like, you've got the Death Star plans that fit on what looks an awful lot like a hard drive to me. And just one of those. But somehow you need this huge goldstone-sized dish to transmit that data. Like, okay, there's a shield generator. I get it. But still, it seems a little weird.
And the building is huge, right? Like, what are they storing there? If one Death Star is, you know, the size of a piece of bread. You know, what else is in there? It must be all of Darth Vader's holographic messages to his pen pal. I don't know.
True, all the work orders, you know, that's what they don't tell us is, you know, all the time that the Rebel Alliance had to sift through, you know, all of that bits of flotsam and jetsam that come along with any big project.
Yeah, anyways, so I would avoid the holograms, but they do make for some interesting visual pieces.
That's definitely true. The Empire loves weird architecture. Like, there's no place where they cannot put a tower or hang something off the side of a cliff or stick it into, you know, a lava flow. They pick bad places. You know, the maintenance bills must be crazy.
And why is Darth Vader living on a lava planet? Fool me once, shame on me, right? Like, wouldn't he be terrified of lava at this point? Wouldn't you want to avoid it? Or he's like trying to, you know, stick it to the lava being like, haha, I'm going to live by you because, you know, you can't kill me. It doesn't make any sense.
So for those of you out there who've managed to get this far without seeing episode 3, just to fill you in, the reason Darth Vader looks the way he does is because Obi-Wan Kenobi dipped him in lava, or, well, you know, parts of him and whatnot. So one of many sequences in the Star Wars universe of Obi-Wan Kenobi getting the better of Darth Vader and choosing not to kill him. At least there's at least 3 examples of that.
Did he float on the lava too, John? Do you remember?
Oh goodness, no. I remember that he pulls himself out a little bit. It's another one of these scenes where they've been having a climactic battle, and then obviously Darth Vader, well, Anakin Skywalker at that point is rather hurt, and so Obi-Wan Kenobi yells some things and leaves. There's another example of that in the Obi-Wan Kenobi series. And say what you will about the lightsaber duel in the very first movie. And I realize here that for somebody who doesn't love Star Wars, I seem to have a lot of knowledge on hand about it.
Yeah, I think you're a little bit more knowledgeable than I am. So please forgive my misunderstandings. But I do know that Darth Vader was horribly mauled by lava. And it seems weird that he would then live on a lava planet.
It must just be like what you're saying, you know, that light, that glow of the red just sets off his cape so well.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he opens up that big, you know, door to have his chat. And then he closes the big door.
I mean, it was a meeting that could have been a hologram, right?
If only, you have a data race, my God.
Yeah.
All right, we'll be back in just a minute with the things we actually liked about this movie. So hang on, dear listener. All right, it's time. We're back with the science shine. Yes, there is some here. And perhaps I'll ask Catherine to kick us off with your favorite bit that they got right.
You know, I did like how the Star Wars universe deals with aliens. So in Star Trek, as a counterexample, everyone just looks humanoid. They all kind of look vaguely the same, but with like bumpy foreheads. But Star Wars does take it another step and includes aliens that look somewhat distinct from humans. And I appreciate that because clearly evolution just accidentally created us here on Earth. It seems very unlikely that you would get something that looks exactly like us on every other planet. So I like that there are sort of squid-like aliens or aliens that have breathing apparatus because clearly they cannot breathe the same atmosphere as the surrounding people. And that to me seems more realistic than what you see in a lot of other sci-fi movies where everyone just looks like a human. So I do appreciate that.
I think you have a good point here with the realism. So one of the knocks I've tended to have against Star Wars versus Star Trek is that in Star Trek, pretty much all of the people that you come across are treated as people. Whereas in Star Wars, it sometimes struck me that it was a bit of a, you know, freak show or a sideshow. But since we now know a little bit more about sort of the political conditions that exist in the Empire, and maybe it's just I'm a little bit older, I'm kind of thinking, you know, human nature being what it is, maybe Star Wars is more accurate, sadly.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say most of the main characters are still human, but I guess Chewbacca is a counterexample to that. I also like that they don't have any sort of universal translator. They all just seem to, I don't know, understand each other. Maybe they've all taken Wookiee, you know, in school, and so they can just understand what they're saying. So that brings a bit of realism, too. These aliens are speaking their alien language. They're not attempting to just be automatically translated into English. And yet people still understand them. So maybe there's more of a knowledge of languages within the Star Wars universe.
Definitely. I like it when I see this in the science fiction literature, because there's no expectation if you find something that's truly alien and very different, that they'll be able to vocalize in the way that you can. And so you need to be able to understand how they're vocalizing in order to understand what they're trying to say, and vice versa. But there's no expectation that a particular conversation will happen in one particular language between two very dissimilar creatures. So that is very nice.
Yeah. I also liked their treatment of different planets within the universe. You know, Yavin 4, which is where the Rebel Alliance is. It looked to be a terrestrial-sized planet, or I guess moon, that orbits a gas giant. And, you know, we've discovered a lot of exoplanets, and there are a number of large gas giants that orbit around the same distance as Earth does from our sun. So it's possible you could have an Earth-like moon around a gas giant. I mean, we haven't discovered them yet. Exomoons are really hard to detect, but it seems realistic that they could exist. Although you bring up a good point, John, in the notes that maybe Yavin 4 is perhaps too close to its planet to be realistic.
Yeah, it seems like there's a good calculation there, but probably one that takes longer than we have the ability for. So I feel like with this movie, when we were going into it, yeah, there's not a lot of science here, but there are so many planets. And so you've got a couple of planetary scientists here who are able to nerd out just a little bit looking at all of these different environments. So Catherine, I wanted to talk a little bit about the rings. Star Wars loves a planet with rings, especially a terrestrial planet with rings. And we see that around a number of the examples here, especially early on in that very Icelandic planet, I think. And, you know, it kind of looks a little bit like Saturn's rings as things have evolved. You know, you get more of that extra little pieces of ring particle that find their way in rather than being solid. So I kind of like that, the idea that it's a little bit granular. There are some challenges, I think, though, with rings around rocky planets, depending. The Roche limit, which is a description of how close a body can get to a planet without being torn apart for a fluid body. Of course, if you're welded together, you can stay in one piece much closer than that. But if you're within that radius where any loose particles get picked up, then you can create a ring. And so that gives us an idea of where these rings ought to be. Those rings don't last forever. There's a big debate with Saturn as to how old those rings are. And to my knowledge, I don't know who's ahead right now, but I don't think it's completely decided. For the Earth, it's a little bit more challenging because things that are close to the Earth, because of the Earth's atmosphere, get pulled down by drag forces eventually. And depending upon what the inclination of the rings is, which is the angle to the equatorial plane, you can get different lifetimes. For rings like this, if they're inclined enough, they might only last a couple hundred years. And there are weirder examples of rings in the solar system, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Speaking of these rings, I think they might actually be Saturn's rings. It looked an awful lot like a Cassini image of Saturn that they just sort of pasted onto this planet. So that's my guess. But yeah, as John was saying, all terrestrial planets in our solar system lack rings. All of the giant planets, though, do have rings. Just Saturn's are the most spectacular. But there is one weirdo, and pardon me if I'm mispronouncing this, but it's Chariklo, which is a centaur. These are sort of asteroid or comet-like objects that exist between Jupiter and Neptune. So this object, Chariklo, is only 250 kilometers in diameter, so not terribly large, and it appears to have rings. I think there's active research being done on this particular object, since we don't really know how something that small would have rings and how it would maintain them. Perhaps it is a transient phenomenon, like John said, but there are some curious things. So it seems at least plausible that a terrestrial planet like this one that Galen Erso is living on could have rings. I like, John, I like your idea for what was forming the rings around this planet.
Yeah, the sort of tongue-in-cheek thing I suggested here is, since it's very easy to move a lot of equipment into space and to have lots of Star Wars, if you will, that maybe there's debris from crushed up old Star Destroyers creating rings around all these terrestrial planets.
Yeah, people, they were just desperate to get to Erso, and a lot of Star Destroyers were sacrificed to make this ring in the process.
Kind of like a natural reef.
Yeah. Speaking of that Icelandic planet, I spotted something there that was also seen in the show Andor, and that is blue milk. I don't know if it appears in any other Star Wars series, but you do see it there in that first scene when they're all inside the house scurrying around trying to leave. And it was featured quite prominently in the show Andor as well. Cyril would get some cereal from his mother and pour blue milk over it. And at first I'm like, oh, surely milk can't be blue. But then I thought about it, and actually some skim milks do appear quite blue, maybe not quite as blue as what they depict in this movie, but it's certainly possible. And it has to do with the scattering of light. So just like the sky is blue because there are small particles that can scatter light through Rayleigh scattering, skim milk can also appear blue because there aren't a lot of fat particles in it, which would cause more diffuse scattering, which we call Mie scattering. So that's like when you see a cloud in the sky or dust, those are larger particles and they scatter light more uniformly as opposed to smaller particles, which preferentially scatter blue light. And so, you know, maybe they just have extremely skim milk in the Star Wars universe that appears blue.
Yeah, another example of this that luckily we don't often have as much of an opportunity to engage with as we used to is cigarette smoke, in that that can also appear blue because of the very, very small particles. There's a bit of an overlap in that area between the Mie scattering with those solid particles and the Rayleigh scattering that you get more from gas particles as well. Plus, you know, it's interesting. I hadn't actually really seen blue milk in the Star Wars series before, but man, does Disney push that really hard at their theme parks. So I'm not surprised to hear that it actually has a tie-in. There is also, I believe, green milk for sale.
Ugh. Wait, they sell blue milk at Disneyland?
They do.
Oh my gosh, I had no idea. That's so strange. Because I always thought, I tie it closely to those scenes between Cyril and his mother. It's sort of this infantilizing thing where she's giving him this sugary cereal with the blue milk, like treating him like a child as she does. So I don't know why they would think that would be a good marketing strategy. Very strange.
Yeah, I guess it's just something that's pulled out of the movies and out of the TV series. You know, when you're in character, you know, you want to eat things, I suppose, that are look like they might have come from that world.
Well, blue milk at least is scientifically plausible. I don't know about green milk. I'm not sure I'd want to eat green milk. That sounds like it could be contaminated or growing something. So maybe stay away from the green milk.
Yeah, something's clearly wrong with that one, I think.
So another thing I wanted to discuss was the scene where the Death Star destroys the Holy City on Jeddah. And there's some science shy and there's some science gripes here packaged into one. So what I thought was really cool about this, it looks like a nuclear detonation from space, as we were talking about earlier with impact cratering. And what I love is that you see that overturn of the rocks, the strata. So this is something we see in impact cratering where, let's say you have layered sedimentary rocks like sandstones on top of limestone, as you see in the Grand Canyon, if you've ever been there. And so what happens with an impact is they actually get like flipped over. So think about taking your hand and bending it backwards. That's sort of what's happening to the rocks. And we see this in impact craters. I was just at Meteor Crater a few weeks ago in Arizona, and that's one of the classic examples of where you can see those sedimentary rocks being flipped over and placed on top of themselves. And you see that happening in the sequence. And I thought that was very cool. The thing I didn't like about the sequence is it just took too long. So impacts, explosions are very, very quick. So for something the size of this impact, it would take maybe a minute for that whole sequence to complete. I was guesstimating the distance between Jeddah and Saw Gerrera's outpost based on some information I found on the Wikipedia, which is fun. So I thought maybe it was about 50 kilometers in diameter. And so that would give you an explosion time about a minute. And I timed the sequence and it was okay, it was 3.5 minutes. So, you know, they were close, but not quite. And I do understand they needed time for their characters to like run away, but it is very hard to run away from an explosion like that. So I understand why they did it for dramatic reasons. But honestly, if you're near an impact crater that big, you are going to get crushed or vaporized. You know, you're not going to run away in your spaceship.
Hey, I'm impressed it's as close as it is, to be frank, because I was looking at this scene and thinking, you know, oh, well, that whole trope about people running away from explosions, this takes it to a whole new level. And I've got to give props here to Wikipedia. That's where I got the Death Star plans. So maybe the Rebels should have just gone there.
Yes, yes. Maybe they wouldn't have needed that huge Empire State Building sized data repository if they just could look things up on Wikipedia.
Well, you had some interesting thoughts, I think, about that facility and particularly the defense shield protecting it.
Yeah, so they made this big deal about not being able to communicate with the rebels in orbit about the planet. They wanted to send them the Death Star plans, but this shield was blocking all radiation from the planet, so they couldn't talk to them. And I was trying to think, well, how would you make a shield like that? How would you prevent radio transmissions? And the first thing that came to mind was something called a Faraday cage. So this is something that you sometimes see protecting sensitive equipment. It's usually a box made of a mesh of metal. you need a continuous covering of some sort of conductive material. And so they kind of disperse the electric charges and protect what's inside from the electromagnetic waves. Clearly, there was no mesh of metal surrounding this planet. We didn't see that. But it could have possibly have been a plasma. Could you make a Faraday cage out of a plasma? And the answer is maybe. I looked into this, and depending on the plasma frequency within the plasma, there are certain frequencies that you could block. So maybe they had this weird plasma-like Faraday cage surrounding the planet, preventing the radio transmissions from getting through. I don't know. What do you think about that idea?
Well, we ran into something similar, I think, when we were talking about contact a few episodes ago and trying to think about, you know, the frequencies that would make it out of the Earth's atmosphere versus which ones actually sort of bounce off the ionosphere, because you can do that to communicate at extremely long distances. So I can definitely see something that blocks particular frequencies. Maybe it's a chicken and egg thing. They have their dish tuned to the frequencies that are blocked by the shield cage. So it's a real shame the Rebels did not bring their own communication device with them. But something that does that and destroys ships, that's a little harder.
It is. You'd need quite the material there. Some sort of, maybe if you surrounded the planet in a giant lightsaber-like material, it would serve both purposes. As we talked about earlier, you know, there's some thought that the lightsabers are made of plasma. But yeah, I wouldn't want to run into a planetary shield made of lightsaber material. That sounds pretty terrible.
So I think maybe to conclude the science shine, I wanted to actually ask you a question. So I think this might be shine, but maybe it's not. And I think you might know. So when they went to Edu, which is a very stormy planet, or maybe just was stormy on the day that they were there, you have all of these tall spires. And of course, you know, Star Wars, you know, if ever there's terrain you can be close to, they love that. So you're going in between these spires. And it reminded me of some of the cliffs that you see, well, not cliffs, but some of the hills that you see in limestone formations, where you sort of, you're rowed away down between and you've got all of these tall standing towers. But they always look a little bit more melty to my eye than what we saw here. These were more sharp. But I know that some rocks, rather than, you know, having that kind of chemical weathering, will just sort of break and fracture away a little bit. So what did you think of this particular landscape?
Well, I'll say in general, the more weather you have, the more muted your topography typically is. But as you say, there are some exceptions to that rule. And as you were talking, it immediately brought to mind that sort of limestone-like chemical weathering, where you can get, you know, still quite a bit of topography in a heavily weathered environment, because it's not eroding mechanically like you would, you know, if a river were to cut through it, but rather chemical. And we see features like this on Titan that are very weird. They're called labyrinth terrains. And we think it might be some sort of chemical weathering happening there. But basically, what they look like uplifted regions that have just been cut through by rivers and other fluvial processes, making this very uneven terrain. So I wouldn't say it's common, but I wouldn't say it's out of the question that you could have a terrain like this in a heavily weathered planet like Edu.
Well, neat to see. And thanks for that. You now have the right to put me on the spot in a future episode.
Excellent. Excellent.
All right. Well, we'll be right back with the Of Its Time section after this little break.
All right, welcome back. So Rogue One is a movie that came out in December of 2016. It was filmed from August of 2015 through February of 2016. So this is about 10 years ago now. But as I was going through this section, I realized it was kind of a tough one to do, because this is a movie that was set just before A New Hope, which was released in 1977. And they went to a lot of trouble to try to match their style to the style of the movie from 1977. So not much of 2016 really comes through in the movie. It really is more a movie from, you know, in the 2010s, trying to mimic a movie from the 70s. So that kind of had an interesting effect, I thought. And I thought they did a reasonably good job at mimicking the look of the original Star Wars. They really tried to keep it pretty simple, keep the CGI kind of to a minimum, except I don't know what you thought about this, where they like brought people back from the dead to replay their characters. That was creepy. I could have done without that. That was the most of 2016 that I saw in this movie. And honestly, I probably would have axed it if I could. Overall, though, I thought they did a good job of mimicking the look from the 70s.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely a period piece from the future in many ways, you know, trying to copy that same visual style. And you're right. It's done really well. This has sort of become a thing, though, that bringing back, you know, people who are dead, or at least perhaps people who have aged as well, because we see that in other examples as well. I get that. That little bit at the end is what they sometimes refer to as fan service that way. Like, do we really need that bit with Leia and Darth Vader? Maybe not. By that point, I think it's kind of clear what's happening, but, you know, it gives people a little bit of thrill, I think.
Yeah, the Leia one I thought was the worst of those two examples. But there was another, I don't know if you've noticed this, there was another actor, Grand Moff Tarkin, played by Peter Cushing, who died in 1994. At least Princess Leia was still alive. Carrie Fisher was still alive when this movie was made, although she died, sadly, shortly after it came out. But no, he'd been dead for decades at this point, and they like put his digitally altered likeness over some other actor and put it in the film. Maybe you didn't notice this. No? Okay.
Can't say that I did. Yeah.
In this case, like,
it's just too good.
Okay. So maybe it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. You know, in that case, just use another actor, invent another character. Like, why are you bringing this guy back from the dead? I thought it was kind of creepy and weird and could have done without that.
So I think it's the challenge of canon that there is a story here and the fans expect you to hold to that story. And sometimes that means maybe you need a character, but I don't know. It strikes me as well that maybe you can just try to drive around it a little bit, or say, you know, oh, that person's just not here today. They're out sick, you know, or something.
The other thing, speaking of actors aging, that I thought was interesting is that, you know, this was filmed in 2015, 2016 with actors who later showed up in the Andor TV series in 2022 and 2025. So even though the Andor series is supposed to be set 5 years in the past, but it was filmed 6 years in the future. So these are actors who are supposed to look younger, but are in fact older. I didn't think it was that distracting, though. I thought they looked reasonably the same. You know, Diego Luna and Genevieve O'Reilly, who play Andor and Mon Mothma. You know, I didn't think it was that distracting of a difference in terms of how they had aged in the past few years. Although there was one example where they had to completely replace the actor, which was a bit confusing. So Bail Organa was played by Jimmy Smits in most of the Star Wars series, in the prequels and in Rogue One, but was not available for the Andor series, so they replaced him with Benjamin Bratt. Although, honestly, I thought this was reasonably well done as well. They made them look as close as possible to each other and sort of mimicked the speaking style and acting style.
I was impressed by that, and I noticed the same thing that you did in terms of those actors playing things a little bit out of sequence. I think the hair and makeup department did really well there to actually make it not super obvious that there had been a difference. With Benjamin Bratt, it's interesting because I know Benjamin Bratt from Law and Order, where the character is very different and the voice tone is very different. And it's interesting that he was able to change and to mimic, like you say, the speaking character of Jimmy Smits, because I remember watching it and saying, that looks a lot like Benjamin Bratt. No, it can't possibly be, but it is.
Yeah, I was getting very confused watching, because I would watch Andor, then Rogue One, and then Andor, and I was getting confused. I'm like, is that the same actor? Is that a different actor? So it was close enough that I was getting confused. I knew they weren't the same actor, but I couldn't figure it out. So, you know, close enough, I guess, for someone perhaps who's not paying a ton of attention.
But what is kind of interesting to me is that of the two, between Andor and Rogue One, Rogue One is clearly the more juvenile of the two. It's flatter, the characters, you know, are less three-dimensional, and it is much louder. Like, I didn't really appreciate the omnipresence of music in these movies until I sort of watched the two back to back. Andor's got a lot of times when there's dialogue and silence, and then you finish watching that series and you immediately go into Rogue One and it's like, you know, whoa, I need to turn down my sound a little bit here.
Yeah, and I was expecting to care more about the characters after watching Andor, because now I know their backstory, where this is all coming from. But I don't know if it was the acting choices or the directing choices, but even knowing the backstory, I just could not care about these characters. characters, they were just like, I couldn't tie what I saw in Andor, which I did really find interesting and was engaged with this sort of flat affect that was in Rogue One. So that was a bit disappointing overall. Clearly the TV show is much better than the movie in this respect.
I guess part of that is pacing, right? Because the movie's got a lot of things to do and a lot of places to go and not much time in which to do it. Whereas the Andor series, I did enjoy it. But you know, as I was telling Catherine before, I think it suffers from a lot of these sorts of really highly serialized things today in that it kind of draws things out a little bit further than maybe they need to be. So you go from slow pacing to breakneck speed. And I don't know, I think the ideal is somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, perhaps that's true. There was a lot of filler in Andor, especially season two. It had a real slow start. But overall, still, I would still much prefer to watch the TV show than this movie. And the critics and the viewers agree it got much better ratings on Rotten Tomato and the like. So anyways, I might return to Andor. I'm not sure if I'll return to Rogue One.
So I guess the other thing that kind of positions this is that it, even though it was mimicking what was going on in the 70s and that visual style, it is very much in this big chunk of 5 movies in 5 years that occurred right after Disney bought Lucasfilm. And I've been looking into this a little bit. It's an interesting thing to happen. I know that I was a little bit surprised at the time. I don't know if other people were. At this point, Disney was buying almost everything. I mean, Marvel came into the fold around then. Lucasfilm in 2012, you know, Fox got bought up as well. And this is an interesting one because, of course, they go out and they make these films and the films do quite well and they have a little bit of a different character to them. You have this one and then there's another one that's a Star Wars story. There's, I think it's Solo is the name of that one. So you've got two of these movies here, which are, you know, trying to build a backstory of character from the original one to try to deepen that a little bit. They've moved more into TV now to fill that kind of role. And then you have those three new big films. And it turns out that in addition to the films, the other thing that was on Disney's mind at the time, or Iger's mind, I should say, the CEO of Disney, Bob Iger, was the theme parks, because those are what really drives the experience for a lot of people. And making a theme park area is actually way more expensive than making a movie. These movies cost in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Building Galaxy's Edge in Florida and California was a $2 billion kind of proposition. So part of that I have learned is because Universal Studios had created a very immersive area that Disney had been offered but said no to. And so they needed something to compete and they needed something big to do that with. And Star Wars was the ticket.
I wonder how that worked out for them. Because I know this movie did really well. It made quite a bit of money. It's also one of the most expensive films ever made. But, you know, when you make $1 billion, that kind of doesn't matter. So, yeah, I'd be curious to know how much money they made on the theme parks versus the movies. Although, like you said, I'm guessing the theme parks probably came out on top there.
Yeah, people keep coming back to those. So it's an interesting experience. I recently went and visited, actually, Galaxy's Edge, which is the name of this particular attraction. And I've got to say, they really did a good job on it. You know, it is very immersive. It's not clear you're in a Disney park. You do feel like you're in a Star Wars area. And, you know, though I'm not a Star Wars fan, the ride is really good.
All right. I haven't been to Disney World in 12 years, so maybe one day I'll take my kids down there to check it out. Another area I thought that did place this in time was some of the references to Jeddah and its place as sort of an Arab-like location, kind of like Mecca or Jerusalem in this post 9/11 world, right? I mean, the original series, you know, Star Wars series was well before 9/11. It was a different world. I mean, that was 50 years ago. It's quite different. But now, you know, we've had all the events of the last 2 decades. And I didn't necessarily love how they dealt with this, especially the fact that all the terrorists, Sagarera's terrorists, were deliberately dressed to look like folks from Arab countries. So they were just sort of emphasizing, oh, terrorists are Arabs, which I don't like that connection necessarily. These are literal aliens, right? They could have made them look like anything. Why did they make them look like Arabs in an Arab city? So I can only guess that, again, that's a consequence of this post 9/11 world we live in and kind of playing to that. I'd be curious to know what the terrorists would have looked like in the 70s. I guess Iran-Contra was a big thing at the time, so maybe it would have been the same. But that did stand out to me.
It's true. That is a little bit of its time, I think. And some of this stuff, like you say, is not well veiled, right? The fact that, you know, they have that particular dress. The whole planet is referred to as Jeddah, which is a city in Saudi Arabia. It's actually the capital of the province that includes Mecca. So you've got this interesting kind of play there, because this is, you were saying, the Jedi Jerusalem, right?
Yeah.
You know, this is meant to be. So there's some religious undertones there, which do, you know, move a little bit more towards the Arabic experience.
And then another phrase that stood out to me, especially now in this post-Trump world, I can't imagine they intended this, because this is before Trump became president, but there is a very interesting exchange between Jin and Saw Gerrera, where Saw says, "You can stand to see the Imperial flag fly across the galaxy." And she responds, "It's not a problem if you don't look up." It seems to be something that people are perhaps taking too much to heart these days. And perhaps we should be looking up and fighting back against some of these imperial tendencies that we're seeing these days.
Indeed. I find not so much Rogue One, but Andor in some ways hits a little close to home, some of it, I have to say.
Oh, yes. No, Andor is definitely placed in a post-Trump world, I think. Basically, it's a show about revolution. It's not really a Star Wars show. It's a revolution show based in the Star Wars universe. And so that's certainly of its time in that way.
Definitely.
Just one last thing that I thought was kind of fun to end, not to end on a downer, but the name of the planet Scarif, that's that ocean planet at the end. Is that right? Where the final battle?
That's the one in the big dish and the shield dish. And all that.
Yeah, yeah.
Stuff. Yeah.
So the origin of that comes from a misspelling of the director's name after he went to Starbucks. So again, not something that would have happened in the 70s. But he ordered a drink. His name is Gareth. And they misspelled it as Scarif, which is a hilarious misspelling of Gareth. And so he decided to name the planet Scarif after that misspelling. So kind of a fun tidbit there I learned while reading up on this movie.
It's almost a little bit like chaos theory. Well, speaking of chaotic things, we'll be back in just a minute with our ratings for this one.
All right, welcome back. So this is the portion of the episode where we rate the movie on a scale of 1 to 5 in 3 separate categories. We talk about the scientific accuracy of the movie. How well did we feel that held up? What the influence of the movie was, or in this case, perhaps also the Star Wars series. And, you know, how does it hold up after all these years? So it's been about 9 years since this movie came out. How does it look today? So, John, how would you rank this in terms of scientific accuracy?
I'll give it a 1. It is not an offense to science. It's clearly something else, but it's not trying to be scientific. It's definitely putting the look before science, before common sense. So I'm going to put it at, you know, our normal bottom of the scale.
Okay. I originally gave it a 2, but then I bumped it down to a 1.5 because it really is, you know, they don't even try to explain most of the science behind much of what they're doing. A lot of it is just sort of magic that they kind of just assume exists. But there were a few things that I thought were interesting. Like I said, I appreciated the diversity of aliens they incorporate into the Star Wars universe. Some of the depictions of the planets were interesting and not totally unrealistic. So I wouldn't give it the bottom of the barrel, but it's not great. Okay, so I was curious to see your rating for influence, though. Can you describe what you gave the movie in terms of influence and why?
Sure. I gave this one just a tad over middle of the road, so a 3.5 here. And I think what's triggering in my brain here is, yes, you know, Star Wars as a whole has been very influential. And the 5 movies that were made between 2015 and 2019, or that were released between 2015 and 2019, those have had a big effect on the culture and reinvigorated Star Wars. But Rogue One on its own, I wouldn't say is the most influential of the group. I couldn't remember the characters at all. If I hadn't seen Andor ahead of time, I don't think I would have even remarked on Cassian at all. And Jin is like totally missing. So I just can't give it high marks for influence because it's overshadowed by these other properties in the same group at the same time.
Okay. Well, I think I gave it a 5, but I was judging the entire Star Wars series, not just this particular movie. I think you're right. This movie does not stand out particularly in the Star Wars canon. Although I think the show Andor might in the end. I think it's one of the best things they've done in recent years. But in terms of Star Wars, I mean, you got to give it a 5, right? People literally talk about
fair.
May the 4th, you know, like the radio wouldn't stop playing Star Wars music, which is not something you see for any other series, right? That this one day a year people mm-hmm. are celebrating a sci-fi series. So yeah, I mean, Star Wars, everyone knows Star Wars. It has a huge influence on our culture. And then lastly, how does it hold up?
So I think this is a place where we're both in violent agreement that this was a film that was well done at the time. It was done in a way that made it look a little bit like I said, a period piece from the future. And it could have been made yesterday, as far as I'm concerned. There's maybe a little bit to knock it down, some of the things that we talked about in the of its time a little bit there. But it's pretty close to being, you know, something that is still very, very present.
Yeah, I gave this a 4.5, as did John. And there were a few things, like those CGI bringing people back from the dead, that were kind of creepy, and I didn't love that. But most of my complaints with this movie are due to probably the acting and directing, not the look. The look is great. I mean, the set pieces that, you know, the on-location shoots they do, Star Wars always does an amazing job. I didn't really remember watching this movie when it first came out, but watching it again, I do remember that first scene where they land in Iceland. That really stood out in my mind. There's some great on-location shooting that I thought was very well done.
There is something to be said for that, putting the look of things ahead of the science, you know, at least in terms of the memory.
Indeed. Well, is there anything else you want to add before we sign off here?
Well, I don't think there's much to say other than from Catherine and I. Until the next time, may the Force be with you. Science is hosted by Catherine Nish and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.